Eagles primarily are not overly scared of the hazing tactics that we use.
Eagles hit two Alaska Airlines jets taking off in Sitka. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 9th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state takes an unusual step to keep a case open.
The fact that they've been able to hide for the last 10 years shouldn't be a way that they can get around being charged with this offense.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
A second aircraft sent to Sitka on Sunday to replace Alaska Airlines Flight 68 after it was grounded by an Eagle strike also hit an Eagle on takeoff. The Department of Transportation confirms that the substitute aircraft struck the bird on the runway but was able to proceed normally with its flight to Seattle. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Roger Weatherall is the Chief Communications Officer for the DOT.
To the best of my knowledge, at this point, there have been two Eagles that have died as a result of collisions with large aircraft down there.
Weatherall says the second Eagle was killed by the collision with the replacement aircraft, but was apparently not ingested by the plane's jet engines. DOT crews subsequently recovered the bird's carcass. Weatherall says the DOT works with the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife on bird mitigation at all the state's airports, but the large raptors can present a special problem.
Eagles primarily are not overly scared of the hazing tactics that we use. They'll depart the area, but shortly thereafter they'll return. Perhaps it's a territorial nature.
Alaska Airlines Flight 68 was forced to abort takeoff shortly after 10 a.m. Sunday morning when the Eagle was sucked into its left engine. The abrupt change in the pitch of the engine was audible in Sitka. Hikers as far away as Gavin Hill reported hearing the unusual change in the aircraft's sound. The affected engine automatically shut down and the Boeing 737-400 braked to a halt halfway down Sitka's 6,500-foot runway. None of the plane's 134 passengers or five crew members was injured in the mishap. Eagle strikes are unusual at the Sitka airport, but not rare. Weatherall says a third bird was struck earlier in the year. It survived and was delivered to the care of the Raptor Rehabilitation Center. Weatherall says preventing Eagle strikes will continue to require exceptional vigilance on the part of the DOT in Sitka.
There really is a high concentration of Eagle's nests that our crews have detected in and around the airport. We've found eight nests, Eagle's nests, near the airport, five of which are on the causeway, and then one that is just about on airport property.
Eagles are federally protected under the Bald Eagle Protection Act of 1940. Weatherall says the federal permits required to relocate the nests would be extraordinarily difficult to obtain. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Alaska Department of Law has filed charges for the first time in a case using a DNA profile instead of a name. The 10-year statute of limitations on the rape and kidnapping case was scheduled to expire today. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Even though the Department of Law doesn't know the name of the suspect, they filed charges against his DNA using the alias John Doe. Deputy Attorney General Rick Svobodny.
We think it's a very good idea to hold rapists and kidnappers accountable for their crimes, and the fact that they've been able to hide, and hide by that, I mean we haven't been able to identify who the person is for the last 10 years, shouldn't be a way that they can get around being charged with this offense.
According to the charging document, the rape and kidnapping took place in Anchorage on August 9th, 2000. The suspect picked up the victim, saying he would give her a ride, but instead drove to an industrial area of the city and raped her, threatening her with a knife. Svobodny says he knows of at least two other states, California and Michigan, where charges have been filed against a DNA profile. He says in California, a similar case survived a challenge before the state's Supreme Court.
This charging document is more accurate in defining who committed the crime than just simply using somebody's name. There are a lot of people across the country who have the same names as other people. So what we do is use a date of birth and their names, but this way is substantially more definitive as to who did it.
Every state is a member of the National DNA Database System called CODIS. Svobodny says that should allow the suspect to be identified if he turns up in the criminal justice system anywhere in the U.S.
For example, in this case, if Florida has somebody who meets their qualifications for a DNA sample, generally that's either arrest or conviction, they put that in their DNA database that once a week gets sent to the national one, and the national one inquires of all the other states to see whether or not they have a hit.
Svobodny says even though the case is a decade old, he thinks John Doe will eventually be brought to justice.
I'm optimistic that it will be solved. I just can't tell you how soon it will be solved. It just depends upon when that person reenters the system with a DNA profile.
The 10-year statute of limitations for rape and kidnapping cases doesn't exist anymore in Alaska. For that reason, Svobodny doesn't think the Department of Law will be using this technique very much in the future, although he says it could be used in cases where there still is a statute of limitations, like first-degree assault. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
A judge has set a December jury trial for Alaska Fish and Game Commissioner Denby Lloyd, who is accused of driving under the influence. The judge prohibited Lloyd from drinking alcohol while the case is pending, but otherwise did not set bail or any travel restrictions. Authorities say a breath test revealed Lloyd had a 0.143 blood alcohol level after being stopped for a traffic violation. The legal limit is 0.08. Lloyd was arrested in Juneau yesterday. Police Sergeant David Campbell said Lloyd was stopped for expired tags but failed a field sobriety test after an officer saw signs of possible intoxication. He said Lloyd took a breath test at the police station. Campbell said the officer described Lloyd as a complete gentleman throughout. Governor Sean Parnell said he'd take swift and appropriate action if the court system reveals guilt. Lloyd declined to comment on his arrest. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Fairbanks man bikes thousands of miles to draw attention to global warming.
There were moments along the way that I really wondered whether I could do this because it was so difficult at times physically.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Joe Miller picked up another high-profile endorsement today in his U.S. Senate bid, Mike Huckabee. But on Friday, a Tea Party Express rally for Miller in Juneau drew only 9 people who were not political operatives or news reporters. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has the story.
Since July, the Tea Party Express has been stumping South Central and Interior Alaska for U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller, running against Senator Lisa Murkowski in the upcoming Republican primary. Last week, they hit Kodiak, Ketchikan, and the capital city with a message that Washington needs fiscal responsibility, free markets, and the Constitution. Using words they say have been lobbed against them, organizers declared they aren't racist or nutty or crackpots, just conservative.
You know, we've heard, why are you here? You're an outside group. Well, we have over 1,000 supporters here in your state, and we feel like it's our job to get behind these people and get behind the true conservative. Just because you're Republican does not mean you're a conservative.
National Tea Party Express Chair Amy Kramer claims campaign success in several states, including Nevada, Utah, and Massachusetts. Kramer is one of the original founders of the Tea Party and believes the movement has both Republicans and Democrats running scared. The big draw for Friday's Juneau rally was former Ronald Reagan aide Sal Russo. He likens the movement to those who followed Reagan when he jumped into politics in 1966, eventually becoming president. But Russo says the Tea Party won't be around very long.
What changes things is new people who get involved. All political movements that are successful are all successful because it's new people. They bring the energy, the unwillingness to accept no, and to push for change. And I don't think the Tea Party is going to be around 10 years from now, but I think it'll have a material impact on the political process.
Several speeches were punctuated by the phrase, "Right on," from 66-year-old Juneau resident Elwood Hunt. That prompted an organizer to ask him to speak to the group. Hunt told them he's been following the Tea Party in the media and hoping it would come to Juneau.
As soon as I saw all those old people in the crowds and say no more bailouts and just saying things that were supporting the Constitution, I knew I had to be a member.
Hunt said he wished he could go back to the 1950s, when unemployment was low and government small. Most of the people who came to the rally said they were invited by someone else, like electrician Jim Islander. He says there should have been five times more people there to hear the Tea Party's message.
It's a movement of the people, and it's long overdue. We got to put a stop to the kind of economics that is destroying our country and wreaking havoc on our future freedoms. We're putting a lot of debt on the back of our kids, and I'm a redneck.
The latest political poll shows Murkowski garnering more than 60% of the vote in the August 24 primary, and Miller about 30%. It also indicates Palin's endorsement of Miller has hurt his campaign. Since that mid-July poll, the Tea Party Express has started airing Joe Miller TV and radio commercials. The Tea Party has promised to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on Miller's campaign. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
Canada's National Energy Board is undertaking a review of their Arctic exploration and drilling regulations. Scott Geddick is the NEB's project manager for Arctic Offshore Drilling Review. He says a review of policies was originally scheduled for 2009.
Following the unfortunate situation in the Gulf of Mexico, the board set aside the review of the policy on the same season relief wells and expanded the scope of the review to look at the best available information on offshore drilling. And any specifics I can't speculate on, but that will all be a matter that's looked at within the context of the public review.
Since the 1970s, Canada's Arctic Energy Development Policy has required that companies applying to explore and drill in Canadian Arctic waters must have contingency plans in place that would enable them to drill a relief well within the same season a primary well is drilled in order to respond to a blowout. The Montreal Gazette recently reported that briefing notes for the NEB chairman's address to a legislative committee contained documents that said drilling a relief well would likely take 3 years rather than being accomplished in the same season as required. Geddick says the notes did not refer to a specific situation, but rather was a scenario raised in the context of questioning about the policy. He says the current regulation clearly requires same-season relief well drilling.
Now, as for the specific timing of the well, the equipment and the availability of the equipment and the timing of that well is one of the project-specific considerations that would be addressed in any application that was made for an offshore well.
Geddick says Canada has had only one Arctic project proposal in the last 20 years, called Devon-Pactoa, applied for in 2004. He says currently there are no active wells in the Canadian Arctic or applications pending before the National Energy Board. Alongside the U.S. federal government's restructuring of the Minerals Management Service, the National Academy of Engineering and the National Research Council is pulling together 10 experts from around the country to review and analyze everything related to the Deepwater Horizon blowout in order to prevent future disasters. Alaska is undertaking its own review, examining all regulations and statutes related to ultra-deep drilling and offshore activity. Both Shell and Statoil have received approval from the National Marine Fisheries Service to conduct seismic studies in the Chukchi Sea, thanks to a new decision by a federal court. The oil companies had previously been prohibited from doing any work there because of a court order that blocked drilling. U.S. District Judge Ralph Beislein had issued that order in July, but revised it to allow research work. Beislein amended the Shell order and the Statoil ruling last week. Phil Dyer is the stakeholder manager for Shell. He says the research Shell will be doing will help them find offshore deposits of oil and gas.
Well, we've got mainly research with acoustic buoys, and we've got some research doing research which is called ice gouge and geotech services, and also something called shallow hazards. But we're still waiting for permits for that. We're still waiting for an IA, what they call an IHA, to carry that out.
Both Senator Mark Begich and Governor Sean Parnell advocated for Shell and Statoil. After Beislein's order was issued, Begich met with officials from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management to see if the issuance of exploration permits could be expedited. Parnell expressed concern over the number of jobs affected by the exploration holdups, something which Dyer stressed as well.
Even with this very limited program, we're looking at 300 people.
Dyer says Shell hoped to have all the necessary documents to move forward with research by last Friday. Statoil could not be reached for comment. The Environmental Protection Agency requires communities that use chlorine to clean their drinking water to do quarterly tests for disinfectant byproducts. Eight Alaskan drinking water systems are out of compliance with these tests. Six of the systems are in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
Bethel has three of the eight systems that are in violation. Three other systems are in the YK Delta communities of Alaganuk, Amonik, and Kotlik. Craig and Klawak are also out of compliance. The EPA says these communities violated the Safe Drinking Water Act and the National Primary Drinking Water Regulations by not completing or submitting reports to the EPA that were due on July 1st. Chan Pankomsing is an EPA enforcement officer.
This is a monitoring violation. It's not a water quality violation.
In other words, the water could be fine, but the EPA doesn't know for sure because they don't have the reports for them. Chlorine is a common chemical used for cleaning drinking water. The EPA monitors how much chlorine residuals are left in the water to make sure it is still safe. There are health risks if the levels are too high.
There might be some effects in your liver, your kidney, your central nervous system. You could get problems from that. And it could be carcinogenic as well.
The city of Bethel has performed the sampling and says the water is safe, but the reports were not sent in by deadline.
Through an oversight on our part, they didn't get turned in like they were supposed to.
That's Bethel's city manager, Lee Foley. He says they're taking the missed deadline seriously.
We've put in checks and balances to ensure that we don't miss this kind of report in the future, because this is a serious thing. Even though the water is very good and it's safe to drink, it's a grave issue, and we take the responsibility to the people of Bethel pretty seriously. So we're going to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
There is more testing required than there used to be. EPA calls it Stage 2 of the Disinfectants and Disinfection Byproducts Rule. Stage 2 went into effect in 2006, and EPA is cracking down on getting those quarterly tests in. It might sound simple enough, but in remote rural communities, it's usually never easy.
Sometimes it goes pretty slow.
Cyprian Oglian is the water plant operator in Alaganuk, which is also in violation. Oglian has worked at the plant for over 20 years, and he says he is trying to figure out how to get the Stage 2 sampling done right. He says they have to send their water samples to Anchorage, which must first go through the village of St. Mary's. Every once in a while, they take longer than a week to get to the lab, and then it all has to be done again.
If it's more than 1 week, they'll test us I'm in Lake for that. Another sample to ship it out here and send it back out again for resampling.
In this July 1st deadline, Oglian says the samples made it to the Anchorage lab, but because of an outstanding bill with the city, the lab put them on hold and the samples expired.
I've been requested for new sample kit, and they still didn't want to send the sample kit to us.
Now Oglian says he's working with another Anchorage lab to get more samples sent out to the village to start over. He says he would like to see more lab services closer to home, which would make water sampling go a lot faster. If sampling doesn't get done, EPA does have sanctions they can place on the municipalities. Again, Chan Pankamsing with the EPA.
For violations of this order, respondent may be subject to a civil penalty of not more than $37,500 per day of violation.
But he stresses that's only the maximum penalty. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Rescuers are battling fierce winds trying to reach Alaska sightseers stranded on a glacier after their small plane encountered some kind of problem. Rescuers with Alaska Air National Guard have been trying to reach the sightseers since Sunday afternoon after the plane's locator beacon went off on Knik Glacier about 40 miles northeast of Anchorage. Major Guy Hayes says communications with the stranded Alaskan and four out-of-state visitors has been very limited. He says it's unknown what kind of mishap befell the plane, but that those on board sustained only minor injuries. He says rescuers hiking to the site have been hampered by blizzard conditions. Pac Rim Coal has asked the State Department of Natural Resources for a two-year extension on the company's Chuitna coal exploration permit. Pac Rim wants to construct a strip mine for coal on the west side of Cook Inlet, about 11 miles northwest of Tyonek. The permit renewal would reauthorize 82 water monitoring wells and the installation of 6 additional monitoring wells. Dan Graham, who is heading the project development for Pac Rim, says the request is routine because the permit must be updated every 2 years. Graham says Pac Rim has held an exploratory permit for the area since 1983 and has since constructed the existing wells and a weather station there. He says Pac Rim has no plans to drill new wells at this time, but the updated permit has provisions that would allow the company to do so if it desires. Environmental groups such as Cook Inlet Keeper are opposing the project. The State Division of Mining, Land and Water is asking for public comment on the Pac Rim request. The comment period is open until September 24th. The U.S. Forest Service is trying to inventory all the plants in the Tongass National Forest, including its mushroom populations. A crew of mycologists or mushroom experts visited Petersburg last month to help with the effort, and during the inventory, one scientist came across what he believes may be a new kind of truffle. KFSK's Baladi Kay has more.
So all along here is all cut, pretty much. Like, that was the most forest you'll see. There might be a couple little places. There's another place called Banana Point.
Petersburg Ranger District lichenologist Karen Dillman is pointing out old growth and recently clear-cut plots of Tongass National Forest land to visiting researcher Michael Castellano. Castellano is one of the world's leading truffle experts, a U.S. Forest Service biologist working out of the Northern Research Station in Corvallis, Oregon. He has done biodiversity tallies to figure out how fungi help with reforestation and mitigate the impacts of forest fires and logging. Along with the Evergreen State University professor Steve Trudell, he was invited by the U.S. Forest Service to do a count of species in the Tongass National Forest.
One of our initial questions was, well, what's the effect of clear cutting or road building or any of these other management practices on these fungal communities? So we're in the formative stages this week, been looking at different stands to identify for study sites and doing a very preliminary assessment of whatever was fruiting at this particular time.
As Castellano explains it, the primary focus of the Tongass fungi inventory is on symbiotes. Also known as mycorrhizae, these fungi tap into trees for carbohydrates and in return channel water, nitrogen, phosphorus, and other trace elements to the tree. This relationship, Castellano explains, has two effects. When an ecosystem loses a tree species, such as Alaskan yellow cedar, the system is also losing many species that have a relationship with cedar. This makes reintroducing the species in the future harder. Secondly, if you are introducing a species into a nursery or into a new habitat, You need to introduce its associated fungi species also. While here in Petersburg, Castellano also found a new species of truffle on Omer Creek Trail.
I was amazed to find that I'd never seen anything with its combination of characters. So in my estimate, without going back to the laboratory and doing some critical assessment, I'm pretty confident, by 95% confident, it's a new species in the genus Leucangium, or possibly in the genus Matarolomyces. I have to get in the microscope and look at the spores.
The underground relative of mushrooms, truffles, Castellano explains, are more evolved. They don't have stems, leaves, or any plant parts whose function is not for reproduction. They are essentially connected strings of seed packets. Castellano said he also found a few other species of truffle that have never been recorded in Alaska. Steve Trudell, who is also helping with the inventory, will be doing a presentation on mushrooms at the Tongass Rainforest Festival, held in Petersburg during the second weekend in September. The researchers will be visiting town often as they continue their assessment. In Petersburg, I'm Melody Kay.
A Fairbanks man who rode his bike from Alaska to Washington, D.C. to spread the word about climate change is back and hopeful about breaking the addiction to fossil fuels. Vietnam veteran and retired bush pilot Don Ross started pedaling south last fall, pushing through snow and ice and stopping at communities along the way to talk about the impacts of climate warming.
Going in the winter, going to extremes was what drew attention to myself so I could talk about some of these things. So it was a real opportunity as well as a privilege to do that. At the same time, there were moments along the way that I really wondered whether I could do this because it was so difficult at times physically. You come into a camp in the evening and you're just really wiped out. So, yeah, but you keep going.
The 67-year-old Ross says the seven-month ride over 6,000 miles through three Canadian provinces and 13 states was a rewarding challenge. He says people were supportive throughout the journey, giving him places to stay and providing venues and contacts to get his message out. Ross says the bike trip also provided a direct connection to the environment.
So many, I think, are disconnected from that and don't realize that it's the natural world that supports ours and makes it possible and really enriches it.
He says a lot of people in the lower 48 aren't tuned into climate warming because the effects aren't always as evident as they are in Alaska. Ross says he believes people are the problem, but also the solution when it comes to climate change.
The thing that ended up being reinforced in my mind throughout the trip was just that we are living unsustainably on the planet and that we need to change directions. And so I sense there's this rising consciousness on the planet, at least I hope so, because that really ultimately is what it's going to take.
Ross's days of biking around to spread the word about climate change may not be over. He's considering participating in a portion of an upcoming transcontinental ride organized by the environmental group 350.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Melody Kay in Petersburg, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grantmakers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.